All right, today we will continue on our path and just remind you what we were talking about last time. Introduced Faraday's law as an experimental observation, experimental fact from the mid-1800s. This was discovered. And we went through the derivation, showed that this leads to this differential form of Faraday's law, curl of E plus dB dt is zero. Then we worked out the power supplied by a power source that would be, say, producing this energy, and it would be minus I times the EMF, E, script E, and also we could equate that to I times the rate of change of the magnetic flux. And then we tackled that and used some of our fancy identities to show that a general way to write the work done, to build it up step by step, would be to look at each increment in delta W, delta work done, as I times the loop integral of delta A times dot DL around the loop. And that can be converted to this area integral delta A dot J d cubed x is one way to write the increment of work. And another way then, I think where we ended was that the most general form of the work is delta W is H dot delta B. Now, we had a similar form, trying to remember how we wrote it, as I think E dot delta D when we did electrostatics. And like there, we can take one limit, which is a common and important limit of having linear media. Where B and H are proportional. And then H dot delta B, in that case, since they're proportional, can be written as 1/2 delta of H dot B. And so in that case, for linear media only, we can go ahead and write a more conventional type of an integral as simply 1/2 H dot B d cubed x. And then similarly, in another interesting limit, you often would think J and the vector potential will be linearly related, right? As you build up the current from zero, A will build up in proportion. Should say maybe just say linearly related. And that means basically there should be probably no magnetic media present. Then we have curl of A is mu naught J. Right. And then we have similarly delta A dot J from here. This form of the work is 1 half delta of A dot J. And this gives another form for the amount of work that your battery has to supply, which is 1 half the integral of J dot A integrated over the volume. And again, we can write that in yet another way for a fixed current loop. Like a wire carrying a current I, that becomes I over 2, the closed loop integral of A dot dl. And one more form, all these are useful at different times, so it's useful to have a number of different expressions to draw from. This is also then I over 2, the loop integral of A dot dl. I just wrote what the same thing, that wasn't what I wanted to write. I lost my train of thought. I wanted to show that this is now also I over 2, the surface integral, of course, of the curl of A dot dA, or I times the flux over 2, another form for the energy. So in a lot of problems, you have a steady current and you're trying to track the energy of the system. And it's kind of useful to separate geometry from like charges and currents in space. It's kind of interesting that it's possible to do that. And that brings us to the concept of inductance. So let's tackle this in a concept where we have some number of current loops. You can really think of these as wires if you like. Here's one wire. Let's say the ith wire carrying current I sub I, capital I sub I, and maybe there's some other current over here carrying some current in some direction, the jth current in loop J, current I sub J in loop J. Okay. Then the flux in this equation, this last one I wrote, this includes both the flux through different current loops, and it's discussing also the flux through the current loop by itself. So it's helpful to sort of keep track of the separate contributions to the flux. And set this up kind of in a very general way for n current loops. So we may write a way to do that. We can write W as 1 half the sum over all the loops, 1 to n, of Li I sub I squared, where this L sub I will represent the self-inductance. And that would basically be the energy each term, the energy if there were no other loops present. But then there is the term usually called the mutual inductance, where we sum from I equals 1 to n and sum over j greater than I with an off-diagonal matrix M sub I j times I sub I, I sub j, which is going to represent the flux, say, through loop I caused by the current, when current flows in loop J, which leads to the idea of self-inductance and mutual inductance. And we can write integrals for those quantities which won't have current in them. They'll be a purely geometrical quantity. But to show that, let me start with a short derivation of where this idea is coming from. So if we start from W is a half integral J dot A d cubed x, and plug in the formula for A as an integral over J. No, essentially we accomplished the division by 2. We're only including terms with j not equal to I. And instead of writing over all j from 1 to n, except excluding the I equals j terms, which were already included over here, I restricted this sum to only j greater than I, which if you want, you could have done the same thing with a 1 half and sum over all I not equal to j. That would have been the same formula, because M will be symmetric. A good question. Was that you again? Okay, so I'm plugging in the formula for A, 1 half now mu naught over 4 pi, and we have now a double integral, J of x cross that's not right. I wrote in the notes a cross product. What was I thinking about? That, of course, has to be a dot product. You might correct your notes. I make mistakes, but I don't have to tell you guys that. Sorry, I blame them myself. We've got the distance between x and x prime in our formula for A. And then we have this beautiful looking double integral. And we can rewrite that as integrals over I dl, the way we often do, change j integral over j d cubed x into a loop integral when we have a current loop into I dl. That gives mu naught over 8 pi, sum over all I, sum over all j, k can factor out the currents outside the integrals, I, I sub j, and then do the loop integral around loop ci, integral around loop cj of dli dot into dlj over x minus x prime. And now we see what I was mentioning, that this integral is a purely geometrical quantity. It doesn't know anything about whether currents are flowing or not. You can calculate that. And that contains the information needed to calculate the self-inductance, which I'll go ahead and write now, defined to be mu naught over 4 pi, this double integral over the same loop. All right, so now you'll have the single loop, and you'll have a dl I and a dl I prime, and you'll do that integral. Dividing by the denominator will be our self-inductance and our mutual inductance, Mij, will be mu naught over 4 pi, the double loop integral now over Ci and Cj of dli dot dlj prime over distance x minus x prime d. I've got the d's already as our mutual inductance. And we can also connect these to flux, not only to energy, but we also have the flux relations that Mij can be written as the flux through I caused by loop J having a current Ij. If we divide flux through I caused by the current in J by the current in J. And that gives the geometrical quantity of the mutual inductance. And similarly, the self-inductance can be written as the flux through I caused by the current in I sub I divided by I sub I. Okay, so these are things you might have learned in your undergraduate E&M classes, but this is a kind of a formal way to approach it very generally. Okay, now let's come to the interesting world of changing magnetic fields. And this section is called quasi-static B fields in conductors. We aren't quite ready yet to talk about the full glory of all of Maxwell's equations. We're still missing the term Maxwell brought. But, and we've seen that a changing B field. Induces an electric field. And that's Faraday's law. But there's an interesting limit if the magnitude of dB dt is, to be slightly imprecise, small enough, then the B field physics interactions and effects on currents or charges, the B field physics still dominates. And the E field aspect is small enough to be sort of negligible. That's the regime that we call quasi-static. Call that regime. And a nice thing you can do when this is true is you can make two approximations to the physics that comes into the math and simplifies the math. So in this regime, we can do two things. We can, first of all, ignore the finiteness of the speed of light. And the second thing we're doing, of course, is we're neglecting Maxwell's displacement current that we'll be talking about later. Neglect the fact that a changing E field will also produce a magnetic field. We're going to neglect that effect. Well, I guess saying we neglect finiteness of light speed is, yeah, it's like saying that. So now we're going to set up what happens when these conditions are applicable and see what it implies about fields, their behavior in a conductor. So now we go to a conductor. And we're going to assume, at least for now, that Ohm's law is applicable. And that means the current density is proportional everywhere to the electric field at every point with a proportionality constant that is the conductivity. And let's look at Maxwell's equations applicable, again, without the displacement current. So we've got the curl of H is the free currents, which I'll just write as J now. We have still del dot B is zero. I was at a master's thesis defense, and a student was asked a very hard question by me. Can you name one of Maxwell's equations? And yes, this was a physics student. He was unable to name one. Until he went to the restroom, and when he came back, he could suddenly name one. Don't be like that. You guys know this stuff. Okay, there are two of them, almost. And here are another two. And of course, we have the vector potential that is an alternative way of representing a magnetic field. So if I plug this guy in for B, I get another interesting equation. It says that the curl of E plus dA dt is zero. And I point out that if there's no free charge, and we're just talking about sort of currents now, talking about neutral matter, the E fields will be produced only by the changing B field. That's the only way they're produced. And so we can introduce a scalar potential for this situation. The quantity, since this curl is zero, we can introduce and say that E plus dA dt is the negative gradient of a scalar phi. And now let's specialize to a linear homogeneous medium where the permeability is constant throughout the medium. And track through the implications of all these assumptions in this quasi-static regime. Linear, we're homogeneous, not homogeneous, we're homogeneous. So H is B over mu, curl of B is mu J. Thank you, Mr. Ampere. And that therefore, that is mu times sigma e by Ohm's law. And now in the quasi-static regime here, with no free charges producing fields, we can take phi to be zero, and therefore e is in this regime produced by the rate of change of the vector potential. And we're in a limit where del dot E is zero. And so we can go and look at the curl of B equation, curl of A is then mu sigma times minus dA dt. Using the identity for the curl of a curl as the gradient of del dot A minus del squared of each component, each Cartesian component of A. And if we take the gauge where del dot A is 0, what's called the Coulomb gauge. We'll be talking about gauges later, but there's freedom, I think, as we discussed earlier, in choosing A, just as there's freedom in choosing the scalar potential in electrostatics, because different choices of A could have the same magnetic field. And choosing, pinning that down is usually called choosing the gauge, and this is one of the common gauges, the Coulomb gauge. Then we have an interesting partial differential equation for the Cartesian components of A. Each component obeys this equation, this PDE. And this is a diffusion equation for the components of A. Each component looks just like a Schrodinger equation, actually, of a free particle, except there's no I on the right-hand side. So instead of solutions like e to the minus IET we're used to in Schrodinger land, we'll have solutions that look more like that. Okay, so you have a field in the conductor and it will diffuse, just like heat diffuses through a gas or an object. So once we see a partial differential equation, it's just so hard to resist starting to solve it. I can't resist it, so I'm going to go there. And it's a pretty nice little partial differential equation. Okay, so we're going to separate variables. Space and time. And we're just going to think of let's choose one component of A and write the PDE for just one component. Okay. And I'm going to call that component U. As I have done in the notes, it's a function of position in the conductor and time. So we want to solve our PDE, del squared u of xt is constant gamma du of xt dt. And gamma, of course, is mu times sigma, just a shorter notation. We can separate variables and then try as an onset, u of xt is a function of x, capital F of x, capital T of t. If we plug that in the PDE and divide by F times t, we get this equation, del squared F of x over f of x is equal to minus a, well, let me just say it's equal to gamma over T of T dt of T dt. X and T are independent variables, so the only way this equation could make any sense at all is if this is equal to a constant. And that constant better be negative. Right, better be negative. In order to have the T of T function decay exponentially instead of growing exponentially, which would be bad. That would be like total protonic reversal in Ghostbusters. Okay, so we have separated one ordinary differential equation, this last equation I wrote, and we're still left with a three-dimensional partial differential equation in position. But we can go ahead and solve the time equation. Dt dt is minus kappa squared over gamma t of t. And that solution, it's a first-order equation, so there's only going to be an overall constant unknown, which I'll just set to unity and fix that instead when we solve the spatial equation. And then f of x for this spatial part, this obeys what's called one of my favorite equations, the Helmholtz equation. Del squared plus kappa squared f of x is zero. And you all know how to solve that like crazy from your quantum classes, if nowhere else. You could write plane wave solutions, e to the I k dot x, e to the I kappa dot x, for instance. No, you're right. E to the I kappa x. Thank you. Thank you. I lost my mind briefly. Maybe not so briefly. And f is a scalar too, right? I got carried away. But these aren't very interesting. We want the spherical solutions, surely. Okay, so here are the spherical solutions, spherical coordinates for this Laplacian, right? If there's no kappa squared, you all know what the solutions are, right? They would be spherical harmonics in the angles and either r to the l or r to the minus l minus 1 if kappa were 0. But with the kappa here, we're going to get oscillating solutions, not power laws, and they are, of course, in the Bessel function family. F now depends on the separation constant kappa and on L and M. There will be a YLM of theta phi, or we would call maybe X hat, the direction of theta and phi, the direction of the vector R. And either there are two independent solutions, the spherical Bessel function JL of kappa R or NL, which is also written often as YL of kappa R. the regular spherical Bessel function, JL regular at the origin. The irregular solution, irregular at the origin. And both are regular at infinity. They oscillate like sine and cosine, 90 degrees out of phase at infinity. Oh, sorry, x here was a vector. This was a vector. It's f that's not a vector. Right. If we wanted to solve that in Cartesian coordinates, you could also use plane waves. If you want to learn more about the spherical Bessel functions, you can go to later pages in Jackson. Which (425, 427) for the properties, or you could take my quantum class if I ever teach it again, and you'll know about more about spherical Bessel functions than you probably wanted to know. They are, of course, related to ordinary Bessel functions. I'll give you the definition. JL of kappa r is, in fact, just pi over 2 kappa r square root. The ordinary Bessel functions, but of half integer order. And again, these are regular. This one is regular at r equals 0 and oscillatory all the way to infinity for a real kappa. As you might expect, these are solutions of a Sturm-Liouville differential equation. And so they are orthonormal and complete. And you can expand any function in terms of the separable solutions that I wrote. So that leads us to formulas like the following. The ith component of the vector potential then could always be written as a sum over all L and M in the usual sense. L goes 0 to infinity. M goes minus L to L. That's the property of spherical Bessel, spherical harmonics. And we can now sum over all the complete set of the spherical Bessel functions, which means integrate because it's a continuous separation constant. All kappa, all non-negative kappa are allowed. So we have an integral over d kappa. We have some, we have our functions, ylm of x hat. Again, that's the unit vector pointing in the direction of r hat. jl of kappa r, our time-dependent function, minus kappa squared t over gamma. Gamma, again, was mu times sigma. And some unknown separation constants, which are going to, in general, be different for each Cartesian component. So I'll keep a superscript I. And this is actually, it's not just a discrete set of constants that has to be found, but it's a continuous function of kappa. So basically, the solution must have this form. If The region you're solving it in includes the origin. And if it includes the full unblocked or uncut, like in a cut cylinder or something, all angles. Has to have that form. That's completely general. And Jackson calls this a Laplace transform representation. Of the solution. Well, Laplace transforms are right. In general, you have like an f of s and an e to the minus st, right? Then that's some f of t ds, right? Isn't that what a Laplace transform is? Well, this would be a one-dimensional Laplace transform, but yeah, we have the other spatial stuff going on too. I guess the Laplace transform is only talking about the time aspect of the solution. But then we have the space in our expanded in our separable solutions. So a first order differential equation, remember, it's very like the Schrodinger equation because it's first order. If you know u of x at t equals 0, basically, that's enough to tell you through this equation the solution at all times. Just like in Schrodinger equation, if you know psi of 0, you'll just propagate that in time, and you know psi at all times. To do that, you'll have to use Fourier's trick, right? You will equate this to, at t equals 0, to your assumed known AI of x, 0. Then you'll have to do Fourier's trick, multiply that both sides by the conjugate of that and integrate over all space. Use the orthonormality of the spherical harmonics. Use the orthonormality of the JL of kappa r. And then that integral over this times JL times YLM star with maybe some constants will tell you the CLM of kappa. Then you'll take those CLM of kappa, plug them back in, and do this integral at every time where you want the solution. That's the short summary of how you solve it. And you might need to know you might want to know the orthonormality relations of the spherical Bessel functions, and I recommend that you look at problem 3.16a in our favorite textbook, which has, I think, those orthonormality relations, and I think in the notes, maybe I even proved it, but I didn't cover it in class, but I think I told you to read it in your vast spare time. What happens what? I don't know what that means. In Cartesian coordinates, it can be a vector. Right. Basically, there are going to be three separation constants. They could be kappa x, kappa y, kappa z, if I separate this in Cartesian coordinates. If I do it in spherical coordinates, they are this kappa, which would be the magnitude of that vector, and L and M are my three separation constants. So in spherical coordinates, this separation constant is not a vector. It's just representing the radial separation constant. It's just a scalar.
But isn't that an assumption of that kappa and phi and theta is zero?
Isn't it a function, an assumption of what? No, no, it's not an assumption. It's a choice of coordinate system. The separable solution in r theta phi are these. The separable solutions in x, y, and z are these. And these aren't related. You could write this solution as a sum and integral over all of these with some constants. And I could actually tell you in 1 minute what that would look like, but I won't. And you could write this one spherical solution as an infinite sum over this complete set, but these are two separate things. I mean, it's not like this kappa is the direction of this kappa. But when you relate these, you will find that the relation, or like if I want to write this as a sum of these, in fact, I only have to sum over L and M because the magnitude of kappa is already fixed by the values of kappa x, kappa y, and kappa z. You don't sound happy with this. Kappa is not a vector except in Cartesian coordinates. You can take that to the bank. Okay, that's basically all I wanted to develop. This is the formalism, how you can think about vector potentials diffusing through a conductor that's an ohmic conductor. And there will be some more stuff about that if some of you take ENM2 when we go to chapter 8 and look at fields in and near conductors and in waveguides. Let's just assume that's going to happen. And you're going to keep working hard and learning, and by golly, you will triumph. I'm very optimistic. Okay, so at this point, I had one more topic I think I wanted to cover before going to chapter 6.
Is chapter 6 the last chapter that we are covering?
No, I think we'll get into 7 a bit.
Really?
You don't want to miss the Kramers-Kronig relations. You want to be here for that. Those are really something. Do you know what the Kramers-Kronig relations are? But you're looking forward to that, I can tell. Okay, so this is kind of an aside. I think I've told you a number of times already in the class that whenever you're dealing with energy, signs are really tricky and worth thinking through kind of carefully. Okay, so you all saw some things about electrical circuits when you were undergraduates, if your undergraduate experience was anything like mine. In basic circuit theory, we had energy stored in a conductor. And the formula for that, I'm sorry, in an inductor. And you probably saw formulas like this, 1/2 inductance times the square of the current. And so the rate at which energy is delivered to a circuit with an inductance would be the derivative of that. It's the power delivered by whatever is charging it up is dW dt, which would be IL dI dt. Moreover, the instantaneous flux is at any time phi b, which is the inductance times the current. Another one of the equations I think you have learned in undergraduate E&M, and we've already saw it earlier today. So the induced EMF by Faraday's law is E is minus d phi b dt, which for a fixed circuit is minus L dI dt. So we can also write that dW dt is minus I times the induced EMF, where E is, as we defined it earlier, the loop integral in the right-hand rule sense around the circuit. E dot dl. And so again, that is the power, you could also call it P, that had to be supplied, the rate at which energy is supplied, as you're changing the current through the inductor. And I'd like to relate this to the voltage, normal voltage from going around the current loop. Which is the negative integral. If I take the loop and I start at a point and go around one time, how does the voltage change in one loop around? That's minus E dot dl. It's our usual formula for relating electric potential to the line integral of the electric field that we had in electrostatics. So the voltage is minus E. And so this leads us to the equation you probably saw in your undergraduate E&M. P is current times voltage. But at least the first time I saw these equations, I was mixing up V and E in my head, and so I kind of found it useful to go through this chain of logic to connect that V is actually minus E, which is the usual. This P is IV is the usual formula I think you learn in circuit theory. Another way to think of the work you do in moving a positive charge, Q, around this circuit now, the work we would do is minus Q times E. EMF. Okay. And you might, you know, kind of think through, I think it's useful, you know, draw a loop with your head, imagine a B field going through it, maybe increasing. Make sure you understand the right-hand rule and stuff like that, which direction current's going to be flowing. It would be the other direction. If this is behind, if this is out of the, into the board, because it has to, by Lenz's law, oppose the change in magnetic field. And think now, if I am increasing the current, increasing the B field, am I doing positive work or negative work? Or do I just want to go to a party? Okay. Well, one of the great triumphs, we're now in chapter 6, one of the great triumphs of the past 200 years, no, 150 years, was Maxwell completing the set of what we now call Maxwell's equations. This changed everything about humanity. Thank you, James Clerk Maxwell, wherever you are. Okay, so up to now, before Maxwell, we have four equations, which are not yet the complete set. Remind you, we've got del dot D is rho. We've got del cross E plus dB dt is zero. We've got del cross H is J. And we've got del dot B is zero. If we take the divergence of this equation, del cross H is J, we're going to get something. What will we get by taking that divergence? We'll get zero. And we'll therefore have zero is del dot J. What? Zero is del dot J. We learned about charge conservation previously, the charge continuity equation or charge conservation equation said del dot J plus d rho dt, that's what's zero, not del dot J. So this set of four equations is inconsistent with charge continuity. So let's rewrite this equation as del dot j plus del dotted into partial d with respect to time is 0, which means del dotted into j plus partial d with respect to time is 0. And this suggests that all the inconsistencies would go away if we replace j here by j plus partial d with respect to time. And so when we do that, simple little change. Now we have the complete set of Maxwell's equations that describe all classical electromagnetic phenomena. Wow. Now Maxwell apparently, I read a little about the history of this. This apparently was not Maxwell's reasoning. This is how it's always presented today, a really simple argument. How to make the incomplete set complete and consistent. Apparently Maxwell was motivated by symmetry. He saw this symmetrical relation between that changing B causes E, that he sort of speculated that a changing D would cause, or a changing E field would cause a magnetic field. And I think that led him to introduce this term, and maybe along the way he also noticed that this fixed this charge conservation problem or continuity. But apparently he was motivated more by symmetry in his thinking than by this, which is a pretty simple argument and easy to remember if you're stuck on a desert island and wondering, how do you get that other term? Okay, so one thing about these four equations, right? We have six components. Well, thinking in vacuum, let's ignore media. We have six components, the components of E and the components of B in these equations. And we have eight partial differential equations, right? Because the two vector equations are actually six equations. And then we have the two divergence equations. So it seems there is some redundance here. And that redundance is sometimes handled by introducing the electromagnetic potentials. And the logic goes as follows. Because del dot B is 0, right, we can always write B as the curl of a vector potential. Okay, replace one set of three variables by another set of three variables. And Faraday's law, which is still true in the revised Maxwell equation world, it's still true that the curl of E plus dA dt is 0. And therefore, we can set E plus dA dt to be the gradient of a scalar function. All right, so in other words, E is now minus del phi minus dA dt in SI units, and B is the curl of A. And we've represented all six components of E and B by four functions of space and time, phi and AX, AY, and AZ. So if we, I have time to say a little more. Let's focus now on a vacuum. Fields in a vacuum, no media present, which are the most fundamental of Maxwell's equations. The rest had these tricky derivations of electric and magnetic dipoles in the media. But in vacuum, there's really nothing tricky like that. It's just very simple equations, and we can insert D is epsilon naught E. We can insert H is B over mu naught. And look at those equations and see what the vector equations for the potentials, vector potential and scalar potential, look like. So there are basically what we have done, by the way, I should have maybe said this, is that there are two homogeneous PDEs here that we use to define the potentials. Okay, basically we just use these two so far. And now we're going to take this representation of the fields in terms of the potentials and look at the inhomogeneous equations. So let's look at the one we spent lovingly time with in electrostatics. Del dot minus del phi minus d a dt is rho over epsilon naught. This is what we also call the differential form of Gauss's law. And so that now looks like del squared phi plus d by dt of del dot a is minus rho over epsilon naught. That's one of the inhomogeneous equations. The other one is del cross a equals mu naught j plus epsilon naught mu naught dE dt. Okay. And using the usual identity for the curl of a curl, right, del of del dot a is minus del squared a plus del of del dot a we get the other PDE that this is right mu naught j plus epsilon naught mu naught dE dt. And that gives that this is equal to mu naught j minus 1 over c squared. Where did I go with, yeah. If I call epsilon naught mu naught 1 over c squared, I get a minus 1 over c squared. Now, sorry, I'm running out of room and I'm out of time. I guess I'll have to pick this up next time. But let me finish writing the equation. Del of d phi dt plus d squared a dt squared. So anyway, put this all together. We get this equation that we'll talk about next time. Del squared a minus 1 over c squared d squared a dt squared minus del of this funny quantity, del dot a, plus 1 over c squared d phi dt is all equal to minus mu naught j. Okay, so now we have four unknowns, functions phi, and the three components of A represented by four components of partial differential equations. And this has eliminated some of the seeming redundancy in this form of Maxwell's equations. And we will think about the remaining ambiguities, sometimes called gauge choices, for A next time. Okay, sorry if I went over a couple of minutes.